Indie Media is DIY news. It is about people reporting their own news directly without the need for reporters, bypassing the corporate media.
There are 100 Indie Media or IMC websites worldwide providing grassroots reports of struggles, campaigns and protests.
There are so many people here who are saying no to the government today, and this is democracy in action.
Everybody's here. Everybody in the country seems to be here. They're just coming from all over the place. The banners are showing all the tiny, tiny little pockets of the country. Everybody has come down here.
The project started 3 years ago covering the massive Seattle protests which shut down the World Trade Organization's summit.
Uncensored and unsponsored, IMC sites can be updated anywhere, anytime, by anyone.
The open to all nature of these sites means that you can publish your own reports about your own issues and at the same time connect to a global network of grassroots news. What you are about to hear are some highlights from these global websites and from our very own UK IMC Wire. For more information or to get the news direct from the streets, check out www.indiemedia.org.uk. Hello, welcome to the Indie Media London Radio Show, and coming up on the show today, we are looking at the real situation behind the handover to Iraq. Are the Iraqis getting a country they can run themselves or not? That's the question we have to be asking. We've also got stories from a wheelchair user breaking into a nuclear base. We've got stories from the fascism of Coca-Cola. And now we've got a really wicked version of Bella Ciao.
I've been looking for different versions of Bella Ciao, and I found this one yesterday by a band I don't actually know the name of, but I can probably find out if anybody's really interested. But I think it's great. Here it is.
Last Wednesday night, anti-Trident protesters again exposed serious flaws in security at Faslane as three activists, one in a wheelchair, broke into the high-security nuclear weapon base. The three, Ros Bullen from Edinburgh, Morag Forbes and Sue Brackenbury, both from Faslane Peace Camp, entered the base at the north end, cutting a hole in the perimeter fence large enough to admit the wheelchair, made their way without interruption to the inner fence and were in the process of cutting their way through when they were detained. They also painted peace slogans such as No WMD on buildings inside the base. The trio, who were released from custody on Friday, were delighted with the progress they made in exposing poor security at the base and in highlighting UK hypocrisy over weapons of mass destruction. I spoke to Ros on Monday evening about the incident.
Hi Ros, thanks for talking to us. You managed to break through a fence to get into the Faslane nuclear weapons base despite being in a wheelchair. Can you describe what you had to do to get into the base?
It was initially through to the old depot at Tang Lake. That's relatively easy to cut. But so we cut a hole through that. There were two others, one other in Far Zone Peace Camp, and all three of us, we cut the hole.
Right.
And we did get in, and managed to get the wheelchair down the bank and
okay.
in. And then two, which in that area is only single rather than double.
Okay.
And in the other part of the base, it's double.
Right.
Doubled. And then started cutting at
okay.
No WMD on the buildings.
Right.
So we were in for about 40 minutes before security came along.
Okay, then, so about a quarter of an hour before anyone came along. What kind of security is usually around the perimeter of the base?
Around the base, there's regular patrols as the peace camp, and there's dog handlers inside with our social dogs and loose, and there's people with guns on the gate, and it's meant to be pretty high security.
Mm-hmm.
On the same day as we broke in, a new commander was taking over, running the Benno tight against terrorism.
Sure. Okay, then. What legal action was taken against you for this break-in?
Well, we got all of us got three charges. We all got breach of bylaws, which is on MOD property, for being within the first offence. I got 600. Unusually, it was included within our charge, the actual amount of damage, which usually comes later in the court case. But it was actually quoted as 600 for the inner perimeter fence
okay.
damage, and then the other two got 600 for the spray painting to the buildings.
Okay. Why was it at that time that you broke in? Was there any specific reason?
I mean, there's lots of reasons. Obviously, the nuclear threat is ongoing, and the real breach to security is the global proliferation of nuclear weapons. Right at this current time, the US and UK governments are being accused of conspiring to break the non-proliferation treaty,
right.
which is the international agreement to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons. And in seeking a renewal for the mutual defence agreement, which has allowed large-scale collaboration between the US and the UK in everything regarding nuclear weapons besides the actual nuclear weapons themselves.
Sure.
And this is a 10-year renewal. This has been going since 1958, and this is, like, up for renewal now, and they will get another 10 years on this. And it's actually in breach of this MPT. But also, it's just like pure hypocrisy that when weapons of mass destruction are used as a reason for occupying and attacking and bombing people in Iraq, that we've got them right here.
Right. Okay, then. Thanks very much for joining us.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, then.
This action is just the latest in a series of citizens' weapon inspections. In April, activists from Trident Ploughshares breached security and broke into the Command and Control Centre for Trident at Northwood Military HQ, and campaigners from the group are amongst those being prosecuted for high-profile acts of people's disarmament at USAF Fairford during the war in Iraq. See www.tridentploughshares.org for more information.
And you're listening to Indie Media Radio Newswire on Resonance 104.4. B-52-2 in Court of Appeal. Fairford anti-war protest is to uphold international law at the Court of Appeal, the Strand, London. 10 a.m, 29th of June to the 1st of July. B-52-2, Oxford residents... Stop making me laugh. Phil Pritchard and Tony Altich are in court again, together with the defendants of two other anti-war actions. They are appealing a decision made in Bristol Crown Court by Judge Gregson that prevents them from bringing the overall illegality of the attack on Iraq into their defences when they come to trial later in the year. All five defendants face up to 10 years in prison for taking non-violent direct action to stop American B-52 bombers from taking off from RAF Fairford in Gloucestershire. They were in court yesterday, today and tomorrow. We'll bring you news of the outcome in next week's show. In the meantime, you can catch up with events at www.b52.com. two.org.uk.
You're listening to Indie Media Radio London on Resonance FM 104.4. We're now going to play you a track by Violet Vision called Pale Void. Weeks ago, we told you of the action being taken outside Caterpillar's offices in Solihull. Caterpillar is supplying a large amount of machinery to the Israeli Defense Force to be used to destroy thousands of Palestinian homes and help build the illegal wall separating Palestinian and Israeli land, effectively caging in Palestinians. At 7 a.m. last Friday morning, 10 protesters arrived at Caterpillar's offices to bring to the attention of the staff the UN warning that the sale of bulldozers to Israel may implicate the company in human rights violations. A mock military checkpoint was set up, and inevitably it wasn't long before the local police arrived. It was clear from the start that these enforcers of law and order were not happy about these nasty peace protesters disturbing the tranquility of their small lives in a small suburb. Unable to control their more basic instincts, they set about taunting and belittling protesters in the Caterpillar car park, which unfortunately for them is on a public footpath. Some anger management courses for sections of the West Midlands Police might be a good use of public money. The noise level started getting louder than that of the passing traffic, which seemed to agitate the police. When one protester tried to present a Home Wrecker of the Year award, one particularly nasty policeman grabbed the award violently and smashed it on the ground and arrested an individual for no reason at all. On leaving the site, the protesters were followed by a police car and, surprise, surprise, were pulled over and given a thorough vehicle inspection. The van was given a prohibition order despite being recently MOT'd and taken off the road. For this petty and vindictive act by the police, several Brighton community groups will be severely disrupted. Eight protesters, undeterred, returned to Caterpillar site at 2 p.m. for a noise protest. After 30 minutes, the noise got slightly louder as the friendly local police arrived and almost immediately arrested all protesters under Section 25. Various personal items were deliberately smashed to the ground and damaged by the same unhinged PC met earlier. All eight were charged with causing alarm, distress and harassment. All eight were pretty alarmed, distressed and harassed by these policemen, not to mention the 13 hours spent in police cells. We have one of the protesters on the phone here to talk to us and tell us about what happened. Hello, how was it for you?
Very surprising. They were very intimidating. In fact, we've got a major issue because the PC who decided to smash the award has got two different numbers on their uniform.
So the police weren't following the correct procedure for their own identification?
No, or at least one of them wasn't. The one that was particularly violent that smashed the award without any provocation.
And when you were arrested, how were you treated in the police cells?
We weren't interviewed. The computer system had gone down, although that doesn't explain why people in Solihull Police Station were kept for over 13 hours. We weren't interviewed, so we didn't see a solicitor or anything.
And you're about to appear at
Solihull Magistrates tomorrow at 2 p.m.
Even though you weren't interviewed or officially, you know, charged, I think understood that you were wrongfully arrested. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
When we came back to protest in the afternoon after someone else was arrested for criminal damage, when they had the award taken off them, they turned up. We were protesting on the public footpath legally, and they turned up in a van, got out of the van, and demanded that we tell them our names and addresses, our details. We refused, asserting that we had a legal right to protest there and remain anonymous. They said that if we didn't tell them our names, they'd arrest us under for antisocial behaviour, which was just completely illogical. And so we contested that, and they said, right, if you don't give us your names again, we're just going to arrest you. They then proceeded to arrest all of us without explaining why they're arresting us, what they're arresting us for, or being able to respond to any of our questions about the arrest.
Were any of you physically hurt?
No, although they did damage some of our equipment. They damaged two drums, I believe.
So what's your next action with regard to this violation of your rights?
We're going to go to Magistrates Court and go through what they did in the day and the way that they basically denied us the right to protest.
And is there anything you'd like to say to the management of Caterpillar?
We believe that some of your managers at Caterpillar Finance met with the police the day before, and we'd be very interested to learn what type of information or how you tried to influence West Midlands Police in terms of policing a demonstration, because I've certainly got the impression that they thought that we were going to be violent, that we were paid to protest, and that there was absolutely no justification for the protest against Caterpillar.
Very briefly, why did you get the impression that they thought you were paid to protest?
I got asked by the desk sergeant whether I got paid to go on this protest.
Sounds crazy. Well, thank you very much, Alex. Good luck in court, and all power to your campaign.
Okay, cool. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
And to follow this up, we've got... yesterday when I was searching for audio in the indiemedia.org radio site, I came across some news from Palestine, which is produced every week, so here's a little bit of it.
Drop them down and set us free.
Heard by Hassan Andoni, this is George Shmali from IMEMC. As Palestinian President Yasser Arafat told Egypt's intelligence head Omar Suleiman that he accepts the Egyptian demand to unite all security devices in three under a new interior minister or under Prime Minister Ahmed Korea, Israel rejected the Egyptian demand for cessation of army operations in Gaza after the deployment of Egyptian security personnel in the Palestinian Strip. Moreover, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon affirmed Wednesday that he would not allow Egypt to mediate between Israel and the Palestinians, stressing the importance of the unilateral character of disengagement and calling Egypt to limit its role into security issues only. Yet, after Egypt publicly protested against plans to dig a water trench along the Gaza-Egypt borders, Sharon told his cabinet ministers that no ditch will be dug until Egypt is consulted. At the same time, and over concerns that the proposed security plan could develop into disarming and dismantling resistance, Palestinian resistance groups harshly criticized the proposed Egyptian security role, calling Egypt to stand with the Palestinians against the occupation. From its side, the quartet is to meet in Taba on Thursday to consider formulating a United Nations Security Council resolution to set the criteria that Israel should fulfill in order to declare an end to the Israeli occupation of Gaza. Such developments are expected to complicate Suleiman's mission, who started Wednesday another round of talks with Palestinian and Israeli officials. Surprisingly, and for the first time ever, Palestinian President Yasser Arafat told the Israeli newspaper Haaretz that he definitely understands Israel's need to preserve its character as a Jewish state. As well, Arafat's close aide, Minister Saeb Erekat, will visit Washington on June 23rd to meet with U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell, a move that is seen as upgrading U.S. relations with the Palestinian Authority. This is IMEMC News from Palestine. With Israel proceeding with constructing the separation wall deep into the West Bank east of Ariel settlement, the European Union reiterated its rejection to the forceful modifications made on the borders between Israel and Palestine. Residents of Skaka village near Salfit and Zawiya near Nablus, together with international and Israeli peace activists, resumed their peaceful protests attempting to prevent bulldozers from uprooting trees in their fields. This is IMEMC News from Palestine. While the Israeli Defense Ministry was officially supposed to dismantle more than 100 unauthorized settlers' outposts, the Israeli Housing Ministry had been financing them through budgets sent to established settlements. Based on a request by Labour member of Knesset Ofer Pines, the state prosecutor started probing into the illegal funds channeled to the unauthorized posts. Once again, the U.S. ambassador to Israel publicly criticized Israel for failing to dismantle unauthorized settlers' outposts, calling for practical steps to remove the outposts and to freeze construction in the settlements. This is IMEMC News from Palestine. The results of a public opinion poll published by Haifa University indicated that the Israeli Jewish public significantly shifted towards extremism and racism. 64% of the Jews in Israel support the idea of expelling the Arab residents of Israel, where 79% support the assassination policy and 25% said would vote for the banned extreme right-wing Kach movement if it runs for Knesset. This is IMEMC News from Palestine. A group of British lawmakers came under Israeli army fire as they toured the Gaza Strip city of Rafah, close to the site in which British peace activist Tom Hunter was shot dead. British lawmakers accused soldiers with shooting at them from a nearby soldiers' watchtower. This is IMEMC News from Palestine. During the week, three Palestinians were killed, 29 wounded, and 101 arrested, and 8 homes were destroyed in the course of 16 army incursions into residential Palestinian areas at different West Bank and Gaza Strip areas. This report was prepared by IMEMC with the technical support of Radio Aziz. For more information, you can visit us at our website www.imemc.org or Radio Aziz at www.radioisis.net.
The series of apparently coordinated attacks on police stations and other government buildings throughout Iraq last week once again underscored the fragile state of Iraqi security forces that have recently taken on greater responsibility now sovereignty has been transferred. For many Iraqis, the attacks also raise a broader question. Will anything change now the US-led occupation has handed former political power to an Iraqi government? The attacks were among the deadliest and most brazen of the year-long Iraqi insurgency. More than 100 people were killed, many of them policemen and members of other Iraqi security forces. Quote, "These attacks were intended to send a message to Iraqis. The new government will not be able to provide security and the insurgents will be able to carry on at will," said Wimad Nateem, a leading political scientist at Baghdad University. An Islamic militant group led by Jordanian-born Abu Musab claimed responsibility for the attacks. Iraqi and US officials have blamed al-Zarqawi and other foreign fighters for most bombings and assassinations of Iraqi political leaders over the past year, but Iraqi analysts note that the insurgency has largely been homegrown rather than being driven by fighters from neighbouring Arab countries. They say US military commanders made a grave mistake by ignoring the local and often widespread support that insurgents have, especially in the Sunni Muslim-dominated centre of the country. "There was always a miscalculation by the Americans about the nature of insurgency," said Nabil Salim, an Iraqi political analyst. "I hope that the new government doesn't make the same mistake."
And Iraq's new Prime Minister, Ayad al-Alawi, has vowed to crush al-Zarqawi's, how do you pronounce that?
Zarqawi.
His followers and the wider insurgency. He has outlined a plan to rebuild the Iraqi army, which was disbanded by US Administrator Paul Bremner in May of last year. Many Iraqis view the army's dissolution as a catastrophic mistake that left more than 400,000 soldiers angry and unemployed and led to a further breakdown in security. Alawi has told senior US officials that he wants to reinstate 5 divisions of the old army, about 50,000 troops, within a few months. Even after the transfer of sovereignty, Iraqi forces will remain under the overall command of the US military. But Alawi's plan would give the Iraqi troops a greater role in fighting insurgents, controlling riots and performing other internal security functions. US commanders had previously said the new Iraqi army would be a small force that would focus on external threats to Iraq's security. Once the largest and best equipped military in the Arab world, Iraq's army spiraled into decline after it lost the 1991 Gulf War. It put up little resistance during last year's invasion of Iraq. Many Iraqis are suspicious of Alawi, who was once a military officer in Saddam Hussein's regime. During more than 20 years he spent in exile, Alawi became close to the CIA and British intelligence. "People don't trust Alawi and many others in his government because they are too close to the Americans," Nadhami said. The recent attacks, coupled with renewed fighting in the Sunni city of Fallujah, highlighted the difficulty that the new government will have in exerting its authority outside of Baghdad. In Fallujah and nearby Ramadi, insurgents control entire neighborhoods. U.S. officials say al-Zarqawi's followers have found a safe haven in Fallujah and that he has spent time there in recent months. Last week, U.S. helicopters dropped pamphlets over the city urging residents to turn in al-Zarqawi, who has a $10 million bounty on his head. Since Saturday, U.S. warplanes have launched 2 airstrikes on suspected hideouts for his supporters in Fallujah. This is from HoustonIndymedia.org.
Well, Well, we all kind of remember the Fallujah massacre that happened a month or so ago, so perhaps that's why the resistance is strong there. Refugees continue to return to Iraq. This is a summary of what was said by UNHCR spokesperson Chris Janowski at a press briefing on the 18th of June 2004. UNHCR is the United Nations Refugee Agency. Despite security concerns, refugees continue to return to Iraq ahead of the handover of power to the Iraqi interim government. UNHCR is not encouraging Iraqis to return, but is facilitating convoys in cooperation with the Iraqi authorities for those who wish to go home. This month, more than 350 Iraqi refugees returned in two separate convoys from Khuzestan and Fars provinces in Iran to the Basra governorate in southern Iraq. This brings the total number of returnees to some 11,500, with most coming from Iran, Saudi Arabia and Lebanon. Elsewhere in the region, 170 Palestinians who fled Iraq last year have now left a no-man's land site and the adjacent Ruwaishid refugee camp on the Jordanian border and returned to Baghdad. The refugees said they have given up hope of finding a new home in the Middle East and preferred to return to Baghdad. UNHCR is providing all the returnees with transport, assistance and various relief items. In Baghdad, UNHCR assisting 450 Palestinian families with rental support, medical care and other relief items are relocating Palestinian families who have been forced out of their homes a year ago. Only 35 families are still living in tents at the Haifa Sports Club. 140 families have already been relocated. Last year, they registered some 23,000 Palestinians in Baghdad, but the total number in the Iraqi capital is estimated at around 30,000. UNHCR is planning to provide further support for the reintegration of returning refugees and displaced Iraqis in the three northern governorates, as well as for Turkish refugees at the Makmur camp near Erbil, and Syrian refugees settled in Baghdad. They are also planning to facilitate the repatriation of Iraqi ethnic Kurds back to northern Iraq from their settlements in Iran. Read more about the UNHCR's work at www.unhcr.ch, and this report comes from electronic iraq.net. and now we have a track by Culture.
Thank you.
I'm just going to speak to Justin from Jubilee, Iraq. And Justin is in Geneva protesting outside the UN. What are you protesting about, Justin?
Well, today, the UN Compensation Commission, which is a body set up in 1991 after the Gulf War, which awards reparations against Iraq, in part to individuals who were harmed in that war, but the vast majority is to wealthy companies and in Kuwait, in Britain, in America, and to governments. And it's meeting today, it meets every 3 months. It's meeting again today to award probably anywhere between 100, 200 million and maybe even a billion of reparations against Iraq. And in the past year, Iraq has paid $1.63 billion in reparations. That's more than it's spent on health and education in that time.
And who are they paying reparation to?
Well, a large number of countries and companies. Kuwait is obviously a large recipient. Actually, Britain is also a recipient. I haven't run the figures recently, but I think we've received about between about 50 and 100 million pounds in the last year in reparations. It's a very complicated mesh of claimants. Anyone who thought that any company which thought it had lost profits because of the disruption caused by the occupation of Kuwait in the first Gulf War has claimed damages.
So, and yet people in Iraq are living in kind of poverty. What's going on there?
Yes, it's completely unjustified, but it's been unquestioned. We've been raising this issue for over a year now, and it's never discussed in the media. You'll never hear anything Tony Blair will say about this or George Bush. It's been completely ignored, and yet already Iraq is expected to pay $30 billion in reparations in the future. And as I said, the Commission meets every 3 months and awards yet more reparations. And this is on top of the $120 billion of illegitimate debt, which is also being claimed against Iraq.
I see. And what is the nature that this protest is going to take this afternoon?
Well, we're having a gathering of Iraqis here, and we're gathering here. We have banners. Say that this is wrong, that the newly sovereign Iraq shouldn't be paying for Saddam's crimes, and we're going to hand in a letter to the president of the Compensation Commission asking him to call an immediate moratorium on all reparation payments and for the Security Council to actually abolish the Compensation Commission entirely.
And what is the general opinion amongst Iraqis, do you think, on the interim government? Are they happy about the interim government or are they very anxious?
Well, yes, I mean, they're very anxious, of course. I think it's too early to judge. You know, the histories of some of the members of the government are well known, and some are dubious. Some are quite positive. It's a mixture. But what will really matter is whether in the coming weeks and months the government can really stand up to America and deliver the kind of policies which benefit Iraqis, which create employment, which get the electricity and the water flowing again. Rather than trying to convert Iraq into Paul Wolfowitz's wet dream of a free market economy controlled by American corporations.
And there's still going to be 160,000 troops in Iraq. How do the Iraqis feel about that?
Well, I mean, obviously, not a single Iraqi likes foreign troops in their country. Some will argue that it's a necessity because the alternative of them leaving and, you know, potential civil war erupting is even worse. Iraqis that don't like it. What we hope is that the transitional government can put pressure on the foreign troops to behave themselves as they haven't been doing in the past, and hopefully the kind of abuses we saw at Abu Ghraib prison, the humiliating midnight raids on houses, arbitrary detentions without charges. Hopefully these things will reduce.
Okay. Thank you very much and have a good demonstration.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Ma'a salama.
we were just speaking to Justin from Jubilee Iraq, who was protesting outside Geneva. Now we're speaking to Gabriel from Voices in the Wilderness UK, and he's going to tell us a little bit about some of the actions and protests that have been planned in response to the current handover of Iraq. Hello, Gabriel, are you there?
Hello, Penny.
Yeah. Hi. So what is the problem with the interim government in Iraq as you see it?
Well, I think what you have to do is you have to look at who are the new interim Iraqi government, how did they get to be where they are today, and what powers do they have? And only when you've answered those three questions can you actually judge the rhetoric, you know, that full sovereignty is being restored and that the occupation's ended. Well, who are they? Well, the most powerful role in the new interim government, that of Prime Minister, is this chap Ayad Alawi. Who is he? He's a former Ba'athist. He used to be on the CIA, and probably may well still be on the CIA payroll, and has links with MI6 and other intelligence agencies around the world. So he's a long-standing protege of the State Department, and I don't think he has any real credible independence. And I think a lot of people recognize that. So he's the most powerful member of the new Iraqi government. How did the new Iraqi government come to be where it is today? Well, it was appointed by the US. There was a lot of hoo-ha made in April by Bush and Blair that the UN were going to be choosing the new Iraqi government. That's not what happened. And Lakhdar Brahimi, who was the UN envoy, who was supposed to be appointing the new Iraqi government, actually said, you know, Bremer, the chap who got on the plane yesterday and waved goodbye and was in charge of Iraq for the US since last May, he said, Bremer is the dictator of Iraq. Nothing happens without his signature. He has the guns. He has the money. So this is a government picked by the US, at least its most important representatives picked by the US. I say its most powerful member has long-standing ties to US and British intelligence. And what powers do they have? Well, crucially, they don't have any powers over, except one, they have one power over the remaining US and British forces. So there's over 145,000 US and British forces that remain in Iraq. The Iraqi government does have one power. It can ask them to leave. But since its only reason that it can remain in existence is because of US and British guns and money, it's not going to do that. So it can slit its own throat and ask them to leave. That's not going to happen. Other than that, it doesn't actually have any meaningful control over the actions of these troops. So I suspect what you'll see is a continuation of what you've seen over the last 13 months, namely, you know, arbitrary killings, detentions. I mean, there remain several thousand, it's not known how many, but several thousand Iraqis remain in US and British detention. So despite full sovereignty having been held, having supposedly been handed over to the Iraqis, there remain, I say, over 145,000 US and British troops roaming the country, killing people with impunity. I think we're going to see a continuation of the torture and all the rest of it that's happened over the last year.
And there's, as you say, there's 160,000 troops in Iraq, but I understand there's a privatisation kind of process in that private mercenary companies are starting to get even more involved in Iraq. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is again another aspect. If we look at what powers the actual Iraqi interim government has, the US last, I think, October, Bush requested $18 billion from the US Congress for what's called reconstruction. A lot of that is actually being used to consolidate the occupation, and part and parcel of that is the use of mercenary companies. I believe there's something like 60 what are called private security companies, but which are often mercenaries, who are now being employed and to fulfill roles which previously would have been fulfilled by soldiers. Just last Saturday, the US pushed through a new law. They've been passing laws like water since April. A new law basically exempting all private contractors in Iraq from Iraqi law. So they'd already done this for the troops, but now all these private contractors, including the mercenaries, are apparently going to be exempt from Iraqi law as well, which is the sort of classic, for those people who know the history of colonialism and imperialism, this is, you know, a classic thing that, you know, obviously you don't have. You know, your occupying army is not subject to the laws of the country you're occupying. And for example, one very prominent company just received, I think, a $293 million contract. It's Aegis Defence International, which is actually based in London. It's headed by Tim Spicer, who was the chap who was embroiled in the Arms to Africa affair and lots of other things. So I think, yes, there has been a suggestion that it's probably true that there's going to be an increased you're going to see an increase in the number of mercenary companies operating in Iraq, and that role is likely to increase, partly because they've been so unsuccessful in getting other nations' troops to come and do US sentry duty in Iraq.
In London, there's going to be some protests tomorrow in response to the handover. Could you very quickly tell me a little bit about that?
I'll say a few, yeah. I mean, I don't have the full list. If people want a more extensive list, they can find that on our website, which is www.voicesuk.org. But there's going to be the Stop the War Coalition have a protest in Parliament Square between 6 and 9, and I think they have the father of one of the young men who was killed in Iraq recently. I think Nicholas Berg, I can't remember his name, but the father, Nicholas, I think is going to be there in Parliament Square tomorrow between 6 and 9. There's other events happening around the country. I think there's a group having an event at Piccadilly Circus, I think, with giant puppets. And there's other things happening in Wrexham and in Leeds and around the country. And those details can be found on our website. I believe, let me see what else is happening. There's also an ongoing appeal hearing in the courts, I think at High Court. And again, the details are on our website for a whole bunch of the protesters who tried to get into Fairford last year in the run-up to the invasion and disarm the B-52.
We've covered that today.
All right, fantastic.
Which is really cool. So can you say your website one more time, and then thank you very much.
Okay, the website is www.voicesuk.org, and there's also going to be some information up there very shortly about forthcoming protests after the 30th of June, and some of those are linked to mercenary and other private companies that are operating in Iraq at the moment.
Thank you very much. Bye bye.
Okay, no worries. Thanks, Benny.
Now ready for departure.
Experience enterprise to me. Knowledge is power. The way is free.
in the last month, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered and non-gender identified people have marched and demonstrated in the streets to continue the fight for the human rights to live and love. From San Francisco to Berlin and the UK, millions of people demonstrated for everything from the right to marry to the right to avoid persecution from the governments based on their sexuality. The gay power movement began out of the Stonewall riots in New York in 1969, but today many gay activists express outrage over the commodification of queer culture into a giant target market. This year, Coors was dropped as the sponsor of many parades based on its anti-gay policies. In the US, the battle continues to rage over corporate sponsorship over what started, at least, as a political movement. By far, the most controversial corporate sponsor has been Coors, controlled by the Coors family, which donates millions each year to anti-gay and other right-wing causes, started by the Heritage Foundation, and whose side ventures have ranged from the John Birch Society to the Nicaraguan Contras. Following the outcry from queer activists that Pride is about true liberation, not a marketing scheme for anti-gay corporations, there has been some progress. So far this year, only three cities are helping Coors sell beer: Atlanta, Denver and Reno. Peter Coors is currently on unpaid leave from Coors Brewing Company to campaign for US Senate as a Republican. According to Coors, during this time, Peter Coors' views, for instance supporting a constitutional ban on gay marriage, do not reflect the views of the company. For several years, the National Lawyers Guild has been supporting a boycott of Coors, which has recently been renewed in light of Peter Coors' run for Congress. Following a Labour-backed boycott against Coors' union-busting policies, in 1978, gay San Francisco politician Harvey Milk launched a boycott of Coors products that spread across the country, triggered by Coors employees being forced to take homosexuality lie detector tests. Since then, Coors has attempted to court the gay community. It extended benefits to the partners of gay workers and in 1999 hired Mary Cheney to help it gain access to the gay market. Cheney left the company in 2000 to work on her father Dick Cheney's campaign for vice president. That's from the Bay Area Indie Media at www.indiebay.org.
Politician, comedian Mark Thomas, political comedian Mark Thomas and artist Tracy Sanders Wood brought the art exhibition Coca-Cola's Nazi Adverts to Colombia's capital, Bogota, on Monday the 28th of June. The exhibition received widespread press coverage and controversy when it opened at the Foundry in London. The organisers, Imaginative Dissent, asked artists to imagine the adverts and images of Coca-Cola's Germany's collaboration with the Nazis. Coca-Cola Germany not only advertised in the Nazi army papers and created bottling paths in occupied territories, but created their popular brand Fanta specifically for the German Nazi market. The CEO, Max Keith, held Coca-Cola rallies with the company's slogans surrounded by swastikas, and there is evidence that the companies used forced labour. The exhibition of 150 images created by artists, teachers, children and discontented advertisers shows how Coca-Cola is used to working with repressive regimes across the world. In Colombia, 8 Coca-Cola trade union activists have been assassinated, some inside the bottling plants. Coca-Cola faces court action in America over these killings and human rights abuses. The organisers said, "Our aim is to build an international grassroots exhibition where the communities in struggle with the multinationals tell their stories through art." In India, Coca-Cola's bottling plants have exploited water resources, leaving thousands without proper water and farmers destitute as their crops fail. In Mexico, the Coca-Cola company is privatising the water, while in El Salvador, Coca-Cola's sugar is harvested by children as young as 8 years old. The aim of the exhibition is to tour internationally and to finally take the exhibition to the headquarters of Coca-Cola in Atlanta, USA, to show the true story and history of this company.
And a really quick Stonehenge report. This year was the 20th anniversary of the last Stonehenge Free Festival, which was 1984, when 70,000 plus people gathered on land nearby the stones. The following year, the authorities used the police to violently attack the festival community with an unprecedented display of brutality in what became known as the Battle of the Beanfield. The night was pretty clear, rain stayed away. The transformation towards dawn was a tantalising and teasing one, as a thick mist descended onto the stones, temporarily shrouding the site and the gathered crowd, diffusing the early morning light. Then slowly it began to burn off and drift away as the sun struggled to shine through.
Poetic.
Isn't it?
It was beautiful. I was there. It was wonderful.
Cool. I think we've run out of time, haven't we? No? How long have we got? 2 minutes.
We've got 2 minutes. Keep going, Andrew. You can do it.
Okay.
Well, I don't know. I was at Stonehenge. I could talk a little bit about that because I was there. It was so... What's so amazing about the festival is just the diversity of people that turn up. You get, like, lots of kind of London boys up for a party, and you get druids, and I remember...
It seems like you got lots of media this year. There's a report here about two people who were arrested because they were shouting abuse at a corporate media TV crew. Did you see that? I didn't see that.
I was kind of... I heard samba playing down by this big spiky stone, and I thought, oh, it's London Samba. I've got to go see London Samba. And I went racing towards London Samba, and it was the Druids having a samba band demonstration. It was really good. Well, I guess it's time to say goodbye from the Indie Media Radio London crew. So, goodbye, and please listen again next week.
See you all. Bye.